Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are beginning to resemble extinct dinosaurs who suffered from too much armor and too little brain, says the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. It's the kind of straight talk America long ago came to expect from a preacher who was jailed as a freedom rider in the civil rights movement and thundered against the Vietnam War. Now at 79, Coffin is still watching and weighing America's moral balance. Tonight on Point, a conversation with the storied voice of America's progressive conscience, William Sloan Coffin. But first, in a striking blow to the Justice Department's prosecution of the War on Terror, the Federal Appeals Court in Manhattan today issued a ruling that Jose Padilla, who was arrested last year at Chicago's O'Hare Airport and who the U.S. government alleges planned to set off a radioactive dirty bomb, cannot be detained indefinitely without charges as an enemy combatant. David Savage covers the courts for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him exactly what the ruling said.
Well, that the U.S. Constitution does not give the president the power to arrest an American citizen on American soil and hold him indefinitely without filing any charges against that person. That's the, I think, rather extreme claim that the administration made in the case of Jose Padilla, the so-called enemy combatant who was picked up at O'Hare Airport in Chicago a couple years ago. He became sort of a test case of the furthest reaches of the president's sort of special powers in the war on terrorism. And this appeals court on a 2-1 vote basically said, despite what the president and his lawyers have said, they simply don't have this power under the Constitution, and Congress has not authorized anything like this, so therefore it's illegal.
To look back to that case for a moment, Jose Padilla was a convert to Islam. He was a fairly well-known, long criminal record as a gang member in Chicago. He had just come back from extensive travels in the Middle East, including Pakistan. He got off the plane, and boom, he was arrested. But there were then and remain today no charges filed. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think it's important to point out that this decision doesn't say anything about the idea that Jose Padilla is a good guy or is innocent of any wrongdoing. He may well have been conspiring to plan a dirty bomb attack, as John Ashcroft said. All the appeals court said is that if that's what he did, you ought to charge him with a crime and take the matter to court. What you can't do is simply say, I, the president, or I, the secretary of defense, thinks this guy is dangerous, and we're going to hold him indefinitely with no charges filed.
Jose Padilla was the first, and as I understand, the only American citizen who's been taken into custody ever on American soil and declared an enemy combatant. Is that right?
Well, I think that's right. I was just saying to an editor in my office here, this is one of these decisions that's both very broad and very narrow. Mm-hmm. Very broad in what it says, and it applies so far to one person. There is a fellow named Yasser Hamdi who was picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan, brought to Guantanamo. The U.S. authorities realized he was an American citizen, so he's been charged and is held as an enemy combatant. But today's decision doesn't affect him because the appeals court said we're only talking about people who are picked up in the United States, American citizens, outside the combat zone. They carefully distinguished the Padilla case from the Hamdi case. And so, yes, this is a decision that affects this one individual.
Jose Padilla has been held in a military brig in Charleston, South Carolina. What's the government been doing with him if there haven't been any charges brought? He's just been sitting there as an enemy combatant waiting for what?
We don't know, and I suspect he doesn't know, and it's very hard to answer that question because no one has spoken to him. They haven't allowed his lawyer to talk to him or his family to talk to him. Early on, the government said, we're interrogating this guy and it would be dangerous if his lawyer could speak to him, because first of all, he might stop talking. Or secondly, they could pass on messages to Al-Qaeda, so we've got to isolate this guy. That strikes me as one of those rationales that makes sense for 6 weeks or maybe 3 months or 6 months. It doesn't make a lot of sense when you're going into a year and a half or 2 years saying, we can't let anyone talk to this guy because it's too dangerous. But the short answer is we don't know what's been going on with him. He's been held in this brig, and no one has interviewed him.
And yet John Ashcroft and the Justice Department suggested that he had been planning to explode a bomb using conventional explosives to disperse radioactive particles over a big area. This is a serious threat. What did the judges in their ruling suggest that the government ought to do in a case like this?
Charge him with some sort of crime of that sort. Under federal law, criminal law in general, if you are conspiring to commit a crime, usually you can be charged with that crime. And if he was conspiring with others to set off some sort of bomb in the United States, there are criminal laws that cover that. So their basic view was if he did what the government alleges he was doing, that he should be charged with a crime and the government should be forced to prove its case.
So, David, what's ahead now for Jose Padilla?
I think it's very unclear.
Will he go free?
I think unlikely. The government has 30 days to appeal. They'll likely ask for a stay. There's a good chance either the Second Circuit or the Supreme Court will grant a stay and then take this case up on appeal. But even if they surprise us and don't appeal, I think the government would then presumably try to bring criminal charges and hold him as a criminal waiting trial.
And overall, how does the ruling today reflect on the Bush administration's pursuit of the war on terror on the home front?
Well, it puts a real limit on it. It doesn't have a lot of impact in a lot of different areas like searches and seizures and all that side of thing. But it does say the president can't just order someone arrested and detained because the president believes the person is dangerous. That's not the way the law works in the United States.
David Savage, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it.
David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. Reverend William Sloan Coffin is a man of great faith and maybe even greater hope. He was a World War II infantryman who went on to a stint in the CIA and then to Yale Divinity School. As chaplain at Yale and Williams College and minister at New York's Riverside Church, he made an enormous mark as a spiritual seeker, activist, and voice of progressive morality. Coffin was an inspiring figure in the civil rights movement, the battle over Vietnam, and the nuclear freeze campaign. At 79, he is still keeping a knowing eye on America and the world. William Sloan Coffin has compiled passages from his extraordinary career in a new book entitled Credo. Tonight on Point, a bit of moral reckoning with William Sloan Coffin. At year's end, in a tough time, what moral issues are you struggling with? What are the great questions that need asking? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Norwich, Vermont, is Reverend William Sloan Coffin. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening, Tom.
It's great to have you.
Well, I'm honored and grateful to be on your fine show.
Well, we had you. It was a year or two ago, nearer to the aftermath of 9/11, and you brought a lot of comfort and a lot of wisdom to us, and we're happy to have you back tonight. There's so many questions that we want to put to you tonight, Bill Coffin, but let us get a fix on you, first of all. One of the many moving and delightful passages in the book, and these are all pieces, bits drawn from your speeches and sermons and unpublished works, as I understand it. But one of the things you say is, clearly the trick in life is to die young as late as possible. So how are you doing on that score, Bill Coffin?
Well, I'm dying. And I'm trying to stay young. I think that is a matter of live curiosity, great gratitude, and great compassion for your fellow human beings.
We can hear it all, and we've heard it for a long time. We know you had a stroke a couple of years ago, and dealing with heart disease now. But we're right. So glad to have all of this William Sloan Coffin pulled together. It really is a wonderful collection and a wonderful book.
Well, thank you.
Dive in with us here. Another line from your book, and not all are so short as this, but you say straight out that hell is truth seen too late. Ouch. You know how to stick the needle in. What are the truths that we are in danger of seeing too late around us right now, William Sloan Coffin?
Well, I was thinking of the Last Judgment of Michelangelo, which shows a centurion being dragged to hell, one hand over one eye, and in the other eye, a look of dire recognition. Mm. He understood, but too late. I think the thing that worries me most is the self-righteousness that is the bane of all human relations, personal, international relations, interfaith relations. And the worst thing about self-righteousness, it destroys our capacity for self-criticism. And America is quite given to self-righteousness.
I wonder, in the wake of 9/11, if there wasn't a sense of woundedness that justified or was certainly seen to justify that self-righteousness.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. We felt unfairly hurt. We could have said to ourselves, well, other nations in the world have also been unfairly hurt, many of them far worse than we have. And we could have expressed kinship with the world's suffering, but instead we closed ourselves in on ourselves, and the most powerful nation in the world became the victim of victimhood. And then, self-righteously, we decided we could evoke an unlimited sense of entitlement to pursue, in our own way, a struggle which President Bush called, rather shallowly, to rid the world of evil. And instead of acting in concert with other nations, we went alone. Now, my feeling about the United States is we don't have to lead the world. We have to, first of all, to join it. And then wouldn't we join the world with great humility and more wisdom? We'll have a very important leadership role. But we have to be much more humble.
William Sloan Coffin, I can imagine George Bush responding to that and saying, Bill Coffin, and I guess he was at Yale when you were chaplain there. What do you mean? We have joined the world. We've been in the United Nations for years. We've been in every world war and rescued the world. We've sat round tables. We trade with the world. We're tied into the world in a thousand ways. But the world needs leadership now, and the kind of ripping of the fabric of 9/11 was clear evidence of that. That seems to be the president's perspective.
No, but it's all written in documents like the Project for a New American Century, which was written in 1999. And clearly, in this document and others, we have expressed the determination to be the most powerful nation in the world, militarily and economically. Now, that's separating yourself from the rest of the world in a rather serious way. And the Bush's doctrine of preemptive war, which is illegal, and certainly bears that out further. What breaks my heart is that after 9/11, we had sympathy of all the nations of the world, headlined Le Monde, Nous sommes tous Américains. We're all Americans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now, in short order, we have squandered that sympathy of the world because almost virtually the entire world was against the invasion of Iraq. Mm.
In the president's messages, we are ready to go it alone. And that's clearly resonating with a lot of Americans, not with the American we're joined by tonight. We're talking with a storied voice of the American conscience, the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. You can join this conversation. What moral issues are you struggling with as another year, 2003, draws to a close? What are the great questions that need asking behind the headlines and the battle cries? Have you followed the long career, The Light Held Up, by William Sloan Coffin? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with a storied voice of the American conscience, the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. You can join the conversation as well. Have you followed the long career, The Light Held Up, by William Sloan Coffin? Are you still keeping the faith? Do you still believe, as he writes, that it all boils down to love? And does this moral hero of the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War protest era speak to you now in the time of war with Iraq, war on terror? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William Sloan Coffin, you've been quoted recently saying something I really wanted to get you to elaborate on. You said, nothing is more dangerous than misunderstanding evil. Now, evil is a word that's been in the air a lot lately. And what do you mean by that, the misunderstanding of evil?
There's a really stubborn persistence about evil. And the idea that we can rid the world of evil, as the president has suggested, is very, very naive. St. Augustine said, for one thing, never fight evil as if it was something that arose totally outside of yourself. And I think we have to recognize evil. It's basically when the bond of love is rent between individuals or between nations. Now, if I may be a bit theological for a moment.
Please.
If all the nations are not one in love, at least we're one in sin, which is no mean bond, because it precludes the possibility of separation through judgment. That's the meaning of scriptural injunction. Judge not that you be not judged. Now, there's no question about it. Saddam Hussein was a horrible, horrible man. No question about that. And I'm certainly glad he's been captured and alive, so he won't be a martyr by being shot. But the idea that we didn't help him is very false. And when he was gassing the Kurds in a terrible fashion in 88, the Bush senior administration never said a word about it. We were on the side of Saddam against the Iranians. Now, we have to recognize our complicity in the very things we abhor. And that's a very important part of evil, recognizing that we're all involved in it, and therefore none of us have the right to be so too self-righteous about the whole thing.
And from this misunderstanding of evil, then, as I hear you, you're saying, comes the notion that we can ride out to war against it as if it's all on the other side of some line and vanquish evil once and for all.
Right. Them and us. And the excuse me. The notion that we have a right to make these decisions all by ourselves, not in concert with other nations in the UN, in the Security Council, that's a very dangerous thing. We would have fits if Russia did something like that, or the French, or the British even, you know. But we think, and it's so ironic, because here at home, We believe in the rule of law, but abroad we're lawless. We decide what we want to do, and that will be it. Pearl, a good right-wing Cold War warrior for many, many years, said in London not long ago, well, the Iraq War was a question of international law being in the way of doing the right thing. Just back of the hand to international law.
Simple as that. Kiss my hand.
Yeah.
But the president, George W. Bush, is very publicly a man of the church, born again and eager to tell you about it if you ask, and clearly sees things differently from his own background in the church, his own relationship with Christianity.
Well, first of all, let's recognize that people who talk a lot about morals aren't necessarily very moral themselves. And when it comes to the Christianity of President Bush, he's had a real religious conversion which allowed him to forswear alcohol and more power to him. But that's that's hardly enough. He hasn't forsworn inordinate ambition. He hasn't forsworn imperialism, gross injustice. He hasn't turned around and said, we have to be more concerned with the plight of the poor, with the sorrow of the aged and the infirm. We have to watch that we don't get so caught up in defense that we lose things worth defending, like the Bill of Rights. And he concentrates, as does the religious right, on certain issues, mostly cultural kind, like abortion and gay rights. Now, I would argue that, you know, for him to be against gay marriage is to say all people are not created equal, and we must have laws to enforce this inequality. We need an amendment which will be the first in 26-27 that restricts rights of the a minority in America.
And yet, William Sloan Coffin, you know as well as I do that this is a president whose voice and whose worldview resonates widely in this country. Many people respond to it. I dare say that over this last weekend, when he came on television to announce formally the capture of Saddam Hussein, a lot of people looked at that man with his steely resolve, wherever you source it, and said, that's a defender I'm happy to have out there. Maybe not you, and maybe not millions of others, but millions.
I know. And people are drawn to other people who are decisive, and they think it's wonderful to be decisive. Now, far more important is to have the right decisions than to be decisive. And I think he's very popular with people who vastly prefer certainty to truth, who vastly prefer that nothing be ambiguous, that the world not present dilemmas. And that's kind of Christianity, which to me is really quite false. I think Christian faith, and faith says we walk by faith and not by sight, is not believing without truth, proof. It's trusting without reservation. It's trusting a loving God. It's trusting the world to be a place where we can love one another, difficult as it may be. But too many people, Christian right, say love is not the most important thing. Now abide faith, hope, and love, these three. Mm-hmm. And the greatest of these, says St. Paul, is love. But the Christian right says no. The greatest of these is faith, and faith defined by a rigid doctrine. And doctrines, of course, can be erroneous. We've seen that with the passage of time. And, of course, doctrines can divide where love can only unite.
Can build walls instead of bridges sometimes.
You're
William
right.
Stone Coffin, so many people want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them, if you allow me. Pat is calling.
I'm just talking too much.
No, it's great to have you talking. We're so glad you're here. Pat is calling from River Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hello, Reverend. I want to praise you for bringing up the debate that really needs to be discussed in this country, but I have to disagree with you in the strongest possible way. We have joined the world like no other country in history. We have encouraged a wide diversity of immigration in our armed forces, and our success is mirrored by this diversity. God's teaching encourages free will, and George Bush's skill in removing Saddam Hussein is going to give them free will. The UN has proven itself to be corrupt, and I think they're the evil that we need to watch out for, and we need to be careful that we don't submit the U.S.'s purity and skill to the United Nations will.
And let me ask you, Pat, before William Stone Coffin responds, you know, he was saying earlier, watch out when you talk about, when one talks about one's own purity, that we all kind of share, if not love, as he said, then at least sin. What's the purity exactly that you're pointing to?
The purity is God's will that we have free will. So few countries give individuals free will. And the Constitution seems to be a very good document. And we don't want to subject it to the United Nations will, which is proven to be ineffective.
William Stone Coffin, your response.
Yeah, but Pat, I am in great agreement with what you say about diversity in America. Diversity is the hardest thing for a society to live with and the most dangerous thing for a society to live without. And we're lucky that we have lots of diversity, but I'm sure you will agree, we are not the melting pot that we claim to be. We're rather a pressure cooker. And minorities have historically had great problems. Now, when you talk about our skill abroad, you know, it took 8 months to find Saddam Hussein, and where's Osama bin Laden? But let's not get sidetracked about the skills. I have great respect for the military. I was 7 years in it myself, but our intelligence is not very good about Iraq. And we deceived the American people, and we deceived the world about the reason for going in, and we'd suffer under delusions that we can easily win the war and win the peace. You know, the peace is very, very complicated. I don't think for a moment we're going to succeed, certainly not as easily as we think we're going to, in establishing a democracy. Remember, Wilson said, we're going to make the world safe for democracy. And it sounded wonderful at the end of World War I, but in a few years, we had opened the doors to one dictator after another, from Ataturk in Turkey to Salazar in Portugal. And in between, we had Franco, Mussolini, Hitler, and Stalin.
But Bill Coffin, if I may, Pat's also pointing here to a kind of American exceptionalism, and he's saying, Reverend Coffin, you're saying reach out to all the world, build bridges to all the world. Pat's saying, look, the UN is not the world's greatest institution necessarily. He sees corruption there rather than brotherhood, a fellowship. He's saying he wants to protect and defend that pure kind of American flame, as he describes it, of freedom.
Well, it's perfectly right, true, that the United Nations is not the best organization in the world, but it's better than no international organization. And to work in concert with other nations for economic goals, for to save the environment, to try to reduce AIDS victims in Africa, or the poverty that doubles the developing world, we have to work with other nations. And, you know, when it comes to foreign aid, we are the last of the 14 industrial nations in the world with foreign aid. We're very stingy in our aid to foreigners. Mm, so, and lastly, because you were talking about Padilla, you know, when the chief legal officer of the United States fears freedoms embodied in the Constitution, the nation has to fear for its freedom. We're in danger now of losing some of the freedoms that obviously Pat and I are total agreement about. Mm. We need, that's America's strength.
Pat, thanks for calling. Brad is calling from Boston. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hello. It's an honor to speak with Reverend Coffin. I would like to know if you have any opinion about the seeming shift in emphasis of the organized church from issues of political activism and social justice to those of personal and individual salvation.
Brad, thanks. Great question. William Sloan Coffin.
I'm not sure that I heard Brad.
Brad was asking about a shift in the church from an emphasis on social activism to personal salvation.
Right. Well, personally, I don't think you can have a personal conversion experience without a change in social attitude. The personal and the public attitudes are very much distinct but not unrelated. And I think what we're finding in the standard brand churches of America is that clergy are so cautious, like a lot of politicians, that they can become moral failures. Now, a new organization has been just set up now called Clergy Leadership Network, and hundreds of clergy are signing on to recover the biblical mandates, the great biblical mandates to pursue justice and to search for peace. And that will be a very happy thing to see the church, because the church is down to management and therapy and no prophetic fire.
William Sloan Coffin, stand by. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. Many more callers want to speak with you. We're talking tonight with the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, doing some unabashed soul searching tonight with the great and venerable William Sloan Coffin. You can join the conversation. What are the great questions that need asking behind the headlines and the battle cries right now? And are you still keeping the faith? Do you still believe, as William Sloan Coffin does, that it all boils down to love? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with a storied voice of the American conscience, the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. You can join the conversation. What moral issues are you struggling with as another year, 2003, draws to a close? Do you still thrill to the joy, the hope, the progressive Christianity of William Sloan Coffin? Or are you marching to a different drummer? What's your question tonight for our Lion in Winter? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy's calling from Pepperell, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. This is Amy Craigood, Bill. Bill married my husband Jeff and I about 11 years ago.
That's great.
Hi, Amy.
That's
great.
Hi, Bill. How are you? So good to hear your voice.
Hearing yours.
I wanted to write you a note after I read the fabulous article about you in The New Yorker. just to say again how wonderful it is to hear you and to know that your courage and your passion and your faith is still out there. It's just really, really inspiring to me.
And Amy, is this the faith that you share? When William Sloan Coffin talks in a time of war and terrorism about love as the ultimate factor, are you still there?
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, my husband and I made the decision to ask Bill to marry us on the eve of the Gulf War when we heard him speak in Hanover, New Hampshire. And he inspired us so much that we got in our car on a freezing cold night and drove all the way to Washington to stand up and say no. And I think, you know, to hear such a warm and wonderful man who's so intelligent and lays things out so well, I just don't know. For me, I just don't understand how you can think any other way.
Well, I'm sure it's good for him to hear that from you tonight. Amy, thanks very much for your call. Joel is calling.
We all need encouragement.
Yes, we do. Joel is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Joel. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Dr. Coffin?
Hi.
Hey, I'm a student at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. And you, myself, and President Richard Washer had a private conversation earlier this year, and we talked about Dr. King, and you said from your personal experiences that he was a great thinker. My question is, I have two questions. One, how does his speech Beyond Vietnam and his letter from a Birmingham jail relate to the situation we are in with our government? And the second question is, if there are no weapons of mass destruction discovered in Iraq, should members of the Bush administration be brought up for war crimes?
Good, Joel. Thanks for your call. William Sloan Coffin.
Good, hard questions. I think the letter from Birmingham jail may be the most wonderful of all the things that Martin wrote. And I think he was very critical of the church for being so uncritical about segregation. And the church is very apt to say over and over again, as they did to King when he was in Birmingham jail, the time is not ripe. Now, that means we align our suffering in the church with the suffering of those in the church who can't take blacks coming into the church, or who can't take gay and lesbians coming into the church. In other words, we align our suffering with those who cause the suffering of others by their bigotry. That was certainly the case in Birmingham jail. Now, his wonderful speech he gave at Riverside Church on the war in Vietnam, he saw that you can't bloat of the military budget and deal with the plight of the poor in the same way. He saw the great tragedy, I think a great tragedy, of President Johnson, who really understood what the domestic needs were all about. But he got caught up in the wrong war. And the war against poverty was a mere skirmish, and the war against Vietnam was mismanaged, misguided, and we lost that war, and we never have won the war against poverty in our country.
Do you see a parallel then in circumstances in Iraq and the U.S. now, or not, William Sloan Coffin?
Yeah, well, it's the idea that we are determined. I keep coming back to these documents which spell it out. We are determined that we will be the most powerful nation in the world. As a result, $400 billion military budget is more than the total of the 17 next military budgets of the next 17 countries in the world. Altogether, they don't make up as much as our military budget.
But what exactly are you suggesting by that? You write in your new collection, Credo, in the new book, you say, whereas economic power helped eventually to win World War II, the war against terrorism will finally only be won by economic justice.
Yeah.
In material terms, what does that mean for the United States?
It means to, if we were to take some of the military budget and put it at the service of the war against global poverty, we would marginalize the terrorists. We would make much more difficult the recruiting of new terrorists when the world saw the United States was serious about dealing with the poverty of the world, global poverty. And terrorism is not a metaphysical thing. It has distinct historic causes, almost always political repression or economic exploitation. Now, if we deal with the causes of terrorism rather than the consequences of terrorism, we'll get somewhere. I'm very much for eliminating as much as we can the causes of terrorism, but I want to see it done by the force of law and not by the law of force.
Joel and Appleton, thanks for your call. I want to turn to another call. There are so many waiting to get in.
I'm talking.
No, you're great. We want it all. Lewis is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just want to pass an image that I have as a child coming to the United States. I came from Portugal, from the Azores. Mm-hmm. And my parents and I always had a great view of the United States. We always thought that this was we do think that it's a land of liberty and wonderful ideals that everybody. But I think this image is really being eroded. I mean, you talk to people overseas that I've talked to, from South America to Europe, you can see the upper classes, the very rich, still think very highly of the United States, with some sarcasm. But you'd see the populace, the people in the street, not believing it. And this is sad for me, because I think we have a wonderful thing. We have a wonderful experience, these liberties, the ability to talk about it. I grew up under Salazar, and I remember my parents not being able to listen on the radio. So it's wonderful to be here. I still remember these things. I care about this country, but I feel very sort of angry at all these things, all these liberties that are being grinded away gradually. And I'm concerned because I saw this with the age of 10, but I think most of my colleagues and people that I work with, this is something that they grew up with, and it's something that I'm afraid that they'd be willing to throw away. And it's
Lewis, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. William Sloan Coffin, you hear that, the entire observation, and also these two words, sadness and anger, that come out there. There's a lot of talk about anger in this political season, and yet you hear what Lewis is saying. How do you respond?
Well, I'm very moved by what you said, Lewis, because all immigrants, and I think they're the ones who constantly renew our country. Immigrants have a vested interest in thinking highly of the United States because it justifies the decision to come here. And for Lewis to appreciate what's wonderful about the United States, but not to be blinded by what needs correction, is a very moving thing to hear. That's what I meant at the beginning when I said self-righteousness threatens our capacity for self-criticism. Mm-hmm. Lewis is a beautiful example of a man who's carrying on a lover's quarrel with his country, and they're the best kind of patriots.
You say, you're right, there are three kinds of patriots, two bad, one good. The bad ones are the uncritical lovers and the loveless critics. Good patriots, and you're extending this to our caller, Lewis, good patriots carry on, as you say, a lover's quarrel with their country, a reflection of God's lover's quarrel with all the world. God's lover's quarrel with all the world?
Oh, God has a terrible lover's quarrel with the world. You know, every time people look up to heaven and having seen a terrible miscarriage of justice on earth, they looked to heaven and said, God, how could you let that happen? We have to remember that at exactly the same moment, God is asking exactly the same questions of us. How could you let it happen?
Lewis, thank you for your call. And William Sloan Coffin says, keep up your own lover's quarrel with the USA. Victor's calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Bill, this is Vic, and we know each other for a long time. I'm the oldest guy you ever baptized. Anyway, it's wonderful to hear your voice. You just sound great. And I wanted to ask you, for me and for millions of other people, you've always been a prophet of hope. And we're thankful for that. And I wanted to ask you tonight, what are the most hopeful signs you see now in the world, and in particular in America?
Very good. Give my love to all the family, Vic.
Certainly.
Hope has nothing to do with optimism or pessimism. The opposite of hope is despair. And despair is like water seeping into a ship, which is safe in any kind of storm as long as there's no seepage of water, there's no seepage of despair. I think it's a terrible thing to despair. And what saved me is not only my Christian convictions, but when I see how many people carry on a lover's quarrel with their own country, and how many whistleblowers there are. Women in black in Israel, the women who stood by the side of the road in Liberia, all these whistleblowers, we can't despair. We can't let them down. They're trying so much to do what's right, and we have to try to do the same thing. Now, what gives me encouragement in America right now, I think it's a ripe moment for education because an election year is coming up. And what I find encouraging is that there are more and more people wondering about the Bush administration while claiming moral clarity. Clearly, Bush is losing moral authority abroad and also at home. And furthermore, big city mayors, state governors, who watch the bloat of the military, $400 billion, and the plight of the poor in the cities and their state, the sorrow of the aged and the infirm, and they have to stare helplessly at deficit-ridden coffers. They're really concerned now about the domestic affairs in a way they were not a year or two ago.
So you're seeing hope in people who are fired up, who are fired up for change.
Oh, I think anger can be a very great spiritual benefit if it's focused anger. And if it's motivated by love.
William Sloan Coffin, we are out of time, and we hate to say it, but we are. Here you are, a man of God, up to your elbows in politics once again. We're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. We wish you very good holidays and a good year to come.
I thank you for allowing me to be here.
William Sloan Coffin, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.